Back together again, you and I chatting it up. A brand new month upon us, Wednesday, October 1st, 2025, right here on Connecticut Today. We welcomed a noted national columnist, Red Janke, to the show to chat about a new study commissioned by the Yankee Institute and the Nutmeg Research Initiative. That study looking at the long-term economic impact of Connecticut State Police overtime pay. Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist Dan Hard dropped by to talk about some of the state's top stories, including the ongoing Pura saga and some new poll numbers regarding Governor Ned Lamont. I had a few thoughts about U.S. health care and the ongoing partial government shutdown. And CBS White House correspondent Olivia Rinaldi updated us on a Trump administration announcement regarding a drug pricing initiative. All right, we all love the men and women of the Connecticut State Police Department, the only people we know of sometimes on the roads, keeping us free of the crazies that occupy some corners of our state. But the state police apparently have a problem with overtime, and that, of course, drives long-term pension debt. And talking about that today is nationally recognized columnist Red Janke. Now, Red has authored a study commissioned by the Yankee Institute and the Nutmeg Research Initiative. It's looking at the impact of all the state police overtime and how that connects because of the way the state figures its pension benefits to long-term pensions. You've seen Red. You've heard him all over the state. You've read his great stuff in The Hill, Bloomberg, also a USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, The National Review, and, of course, Red has his own website as well. The Red Line, that's the-red-line. We welcome Red Janke to the program. Red, it's Paul here. How are you, sir?
Hey, Paul, I'm just fine. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, sir. First time you're on the program. Great to have you. So talk about this study, Red, and what precipitated this, and digging through the numbers, what should my listeners know here?
Well, first, we should acknowledge we owe a debt of gratitude to the state police for keeping us safe and protected. Let's state that at the outset.
Yeah.
And separate that from the purpose of the study, which is they're well compensated. Unfortunately, they are overcompensated. There is a contract arrangement that they enjoy with the corrections department and about 28,000 other state employees who were hired before 2017. Employees hired after 2017 have had the ability to spike overtime, which is what I'm about to talk about, eliminated. They cannot do this. What spiking overtime entails is working humongous amounts of overtime in 3 years immediately before retirement. Those 3 years of overtime, that overtime pay is included in the calculation of their pensions.
Okay.
As such, their pensions are enormous. The average starting pension of the 13 state policemen that we specifically studied was $140,000. That was 34% before their salary immediately before retiring. That is overgenerous, unsustainable for the state. It is why the state pension fund is perennially underfunded and never seems to catch up.
Pretty much because, Red, as you tell me now and other people have said, it's that three-year preamble, if you will, to them retiring. So they know this, people in that category, and they take advantage of it, correct?
Correct. And this should not be, the blame should be not be laid upon them individually.
Sure.
If you were working that job, if I were working that job, I would do exactly the same
thing. Absolutely.
It is a contract issue. This is, in this case, Ned Lamont, Governor-led Ned Lamont, cutting a contract with the state police union. And these are union negotiators which provides for this kind of overgenerous compensation. Many state police various people have mentioned to me that they've talked with are actually embarrassed by this. They don't complain about it, but it's an embarrassment of riches. There's no better instance to use that phrase, an embarrassment of riches. What we did, so your listeners know, is we went through five fiscal years through fiscal 2024. We identified in each year the 10 state policemen who had the highest overtime.
Okay.
As it turned out, there were 33 employees, because some repeated from year to year.
Yeah.
We looked very closely at them, and the numbers I just mentioned are drawn from that population. Of the 33, 13 have retired. Their beginning pension was 34% before their last salary on average.
Wow.
Their average starting pension, $140,700.
So that's 12, but roughly, even a dummy can, like me, Red, can figure it's about 12 grand a month, about 3 grand a week. Okay.
Yeah. And mind you, they're going to go on to take other jobs. No one works in this lifetime for only 20 years. So at the same time that they are retired from their police career,
yeah,
they're going to go on and earn in other jobs. So this is, they do not need to be compensated to this level.
Well, Red, and again, I'm glad you brought that up, because these are, you know, this is part of a contract negotiation. So what happens, Red, and the guest is Red Janke, what happens, or is there any indication that the governor at any time during this said, well, no, we can't do, this is, as we like to say, unsustainable. Like, is anybody twisting the governor's arm to agree to this or not?
Well, the union negotiators are twisting.
Yeah.
And let's also understand what's going on there. Unions are like corporations. They maximize returns, in this case, to their members and to their own organization, just as corporations maximize profit for the benefit of stockholders. To some degree, you can excuse even the unions. This is all on Ned Lamont's head. This is all on Daniel Malloy's head, his predecessor. Except that Daniel Malloy had some backbone. What Ned Lamont has done, and let's contrast the two, he has awarded all state employees six annual pay raises in a row. Those raises compound to 33% increase over 6 years. In the private sector nationally, the comparable was 23%, 10% less. Since pensions are calculated off of wage levels, that means pensions for the entire workforce have gone up 33%. That's the base case. Now we're looking at these exaggerated cases. First, in the case of the state police. Secondly, we also looked at the Department of Correction. And the pension escalation is astronomical. And when you say unsustainable, this is clearly unsustainable. And it is unsustainable from the point of view that if we have eliminated that for those hired after 2017, we are still have 28,000 employees who can do this. They alone are going to cost the state an enormous amount of money. Overtime pension spiking needs to be eliminated for all employees.
Red, how would that, so is it, that's not in the, I mean, it's not in the, it's not in the state constitution, obviously. It would just take, what, a backbone, as you say, from a chief executive or the General Assembly to say, no, we can't do this. We know you want it, but this is, as you say, not sustainable. This isn't in any law, is it, beyond the contract?
No, it is not. There are legal issues involved that might serve as significant hurdles, but they are not hurdles that cannot be overcome.
Yeah.
This just takes a chief executive with backbone. And we were contrasting, or at least I began to, Paul, Daniel Malloy and Ned Lamont. Mm. Daniel Malloy froze wages for state employees in 3 of his 8 years in
office. I remember that.
Yeah. Ned Lamont, not so much.
Mm. Folks, if you want to check out this report, of course, go to visit our fine folks at the Yankee Institute, yankeeinstitute.org. Overtime spiking in the state police, a study commissioned to and executed by Red Janke, and Red has his blog too. Check that out. It's outstanding. the-red-line.com. Red, good to have you on. We'll definitely get you back on in the future, sir. Red, thank you so much for doing this. We appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you at the end of the day, Paul. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Red. Appreciate it. Red Janke. There you go. All right. Quarter past the hour. Bingo. Quarter past 5 on a midweek Wednesday, the first of the month, October 1, 2025, means we check in with our buddy, our pal, Dan Hurst, Connecticut Media Senior Editor and Columnist. And there is a lot going on. Mr. Haar, good afternoon, sir. How are you, sir?
October 1st, if there's a shutdown, does that mean I don't have to pay my credit card bill today?
Interesting, yeah, right? I don't know, Dan. Yeah, but that's couch change for you. Go ahead and pay it. Look, rich guys like you. Come on.
There you go.
You West Hartford you West Hartford people, come on. Jeez. All right, let's talk some dollars and cents, Dan Haar. Are we in a recession or not, as it pertains to Connecticut and maybe politically as well? What should we be using the R word?
Not yet. There are fears of a recession, and there was one very prominent economist, Mark Zandi at Moody's, formerly known as MoodysEconomy.com, who said that Connecticut is one of 21 states that's in the bottom tier, teetering on recession. Hmm. And when you look at his chart, it's in the red. And Connecticut, as a matter of fact, is 6th from the bottom. But nobody can quite figure out why that is in the data, because as you may have seen a week ago, or even less than a week ago, Connecticut came in with a 4.6% heady quarterly growth rate, which I won't go into the details of it, but basically a very strong top 10 in the country, number 9 in the country, growth rate for the second quarter. How can both things be true? Well, that's what I wrote about, and there are a lot of reasons why they can both be true. It all comes down to this. We don't know if we can trust the numbers, and we don't know the direction of things, even if the numbers are trustworthy. There are signs of a slowdown, if not recession, and Connecticut would certainly not be immune to that.
Sure. All right. Now, let's shift gears. The Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, our friends at PURA. Now, the governor says, Dan, he's having a tough time getting people to serve on the PURA board at about $200K a year, $150K plus benefits. I will do it. Now, I already offered my services up. I haven't heard from the governor's office, but as much as I'd love to do it, he's not going to call me back. This is not an easy gig either to be part of or to find people for, is it?
No, it's not, because the governor, he correctly notes that there are 3 classes of people that could be PURA commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
One is eldern states people, right? The ones that were former state legislators who know the political process and who know the players.
Yeah.
The other is retired or executives, but typically they would be retired executives because very few people want to quit their big big corporate jobs to work for, quote, only $200,000 a year.
Did,
just as it does you, it cracked me up to read the governor say, maybe it's someone who wants to, who's had a good career and wants to give back for 5 years.
Right?
So now think about it. You're going to pay somebody $1 million for 5 years.
To give back.
To be a PURA commissioner.
Right.
And it is officially, by the way, to be clear, it's not like being a board member. It is a full-time job.
Sure.
right? So you are a commissioner, it's a highly responsible job. But it just cracks me up. Maybe we can pay somebody only $1 million for 5 years' work, and they can feel good about themselves giving back. But in any case, the third category is the one he's having trouble getting. And he didn't come quite out and say that these are the people turning him down. Mm-hmm. But what he wants to get is another person like Marissa Gillette, not to say like her in terms of her style, but with her level of expertise. Marissa Gillette, unlike most regulators in Connecticut history who come from the political side, she's a lawyer and an engineer who has done the regulatory work on the ground. And she came from Maryland. So he's looking for something like that. Mm. Someone who, as he put it, can go head-to-head against Eversource and UI.
So you're saying I shouldn't get my hopes up, even though I emailed my resume and my background. Is that what you're saying? I shouldn't get my hopes up.
I think if they expand the commission to five, at least one should be a journalist or a radio personality.
There you go. See, I knew I'd get that from you. Okay, two more things. Before we get to the governor's poll numbers, this shutdown, and Dan, like you said, there's a million ways you could look at this, but the bottom line is always money here. What's going to get shut down? What's not going to get shut down? How long is this whole thing going to last? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we can start by saying that Connecticut is one of the least affected states. Mm-hmm. Right now, that's not to say we are unaffected, but it is. For example, I was just listening to a competing radio station, one that was previously publicly supported.
Okay.
And they had on the budget director of Georgia.
Yeah.
Georgia has more federal employees in their borders than they do state employees.
Wow.
Right? Can you imagine that? Connecticut has about 7,000 federal employees, almost all of whom are exempt because it's either VA or something like that that's exempt from the shutdown. As you know, the Veterans Administration, for the most part, remains open.
Sure.
Most of these agencies have some pieces that are open and some that are closed, but the VA is overwhelmingly open for obvious reasons. It's a health facility, and as well as military, they're open. Georgia has 100,000 federal employees.
Wow.
So Connecticut is relatively lucky in that regard. But I think the greater danger, and yes, there was, for example, women, infants, and children support is about $72 million a year. And SNAP, food, what we used to call food stamps, is about $72 million a month. Right.
Okay.
So those are numbers that the governor just today at his press conference, as you might have been talking about or read or heard, or is saying that we may, if it's a short term shutdown and we run out of money, we may tap into our huge $6 billion budget reserve.
Yeah.
I'm sure nobody wants to see that dwindle away based on a federal shutdown, but we think it'll be retroactively paid back. So that's the short term plan. You know, and where do you go from there? If it's a long-term shutdown, you got a real problem.
Yeah, well, at least, like you said, we do have that surplus that we can at least rely on short-term. And we'll end with more numbers. University of New Hampshire poll, Dan. I wasn't surprised with one figure at, 54% approval for the governor. I'm like, all right, low to mid-50s.
He's been higher. He's been lower.
Yeah. But the 43% he should run again, should we take anything out of that relatively low number or not? What do you think?
If you're the governor, you're looking and saying that's up from 37 the last time they did the poll.
Yeah.
But by the way, the number of people last time who said he should not run was also smaller.
Yeah.
More people have an opinion in this poll. So what do you take from the fact that more people have an opinion? I think if you're the governor, you have to look at the poll and say, a year away from an election, people aren't paying attention, and let's not worry too much about it, as long as my approval rating is above water, and he is way above water. That 54% is not comparable to the ones in the 60s because they're different polls by different people at different times using different methods. But he's been well into the 60s in approval rating. He has no problem getting reelected unless something really big and bad happens, like, for example, a corruption case that goes to federal trial that makes something look bad in his administration. Where could that ever come from?
All right. Finally, Dan, what are you working on for the next day or two or three that people should look out for? What do you have in the hopper?
Oh, I think a little bit. I'm doing a couple of long-term things, and I'm still trying to nail down what's going on with the also in the poll, the unpopular state purchase of a piece of the women's national NBA team, WNBA team, the Sun. But I just want to quickly, in 15 seconds, make the point, and I would be remiss if I didn't, that the federal shutdown, the biggest problem from the federal shutdown is the effect on confidence in the U.S. politics and economics that shakes the nation to the core in the global system. And that's really a problem. If this goes on for a while, we really start to lose credibility as a country. And that's the danger. The danger isn't a few shekels here and there from from, you know, this or that program.
All right, Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media. Dan, have a happy weekend, and we shall chat next week, Thursday. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye. All right, Dan Haar, there you go. All right. All right, so the first thing you have to understand about this government shutdown thing is this is all political theater. This is for the masses, and it always is. Listen, the Democrats see an opportunity here to score some political points against the Trump White House, which they are in dire need of doing, you know, the Democratic Party right now. For whatever reason, whether you're pro-Democrat or anti-Democrat or whatever, they are impotent right now. There's nothing happening on a positive slant for the Democrats here. There just isn't. And on the opposite side of this, you see the Trump White House kind of flexing its muscle and saying, hey, look at that. Even three or four Democrats voted with us, at least in the Senate, to keep the government up and running here. But again, it got bogged down in Congress. So, listen, this is all kabuki theater, all right? And I don't mean to be flippant because there are people who, thousands of people who might likely get laid off or whatever, or furloughed. The White House is, you know, threatening some permanent layoffs, whatever. But the bottom line is this did not have to happen. And listen, the Republicans said, and I think they're right in one aspect here, this is an effort here by the Democrats to step up. And listen, I don't blame them to try and score some sort of political points here against the Trump White House. And they've been getting punched around and dragged around the ring here on policy, and they have been looking to, you know, maybe, you know, regain their footing here. But here's the thing you have to remember about this. So we'll get started with this today. At 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, the two things that are constantly talked about in this scenario, and you heard this leading up to this last night or heard this earlier part of today, and you'll hear it again coming up, there are two issues here. And again, both sides are saying and pointing a finger at the other side saying, well, you're lying about this, you're not being truthful. There are two issues here. Healthcare and immigration. If we had a cogent, workable policy on immigration that we should have had years ago, decades ago, likely none of this would be happening. If we went ahead and took a framework that we already have in place, which is Medicare, and simply expanded that to some sort of Medicare for All, which has been alluded to in the past, if that was in effect, guess what? None of this would be happening. I can't say that for sure, but as I sit here from the 30,000-foot view here, none of this would be happening because you're hearing competing sides on this, Republicans wagging their finger at Democrats and Democrats wagging their fingers at Republicans and saying, hey, the only reason that this is a debate here is because the bad old Republicans want to get rid of some Obamacare subsidies. And the Republicans are saying to the Democrats, hey, the only reason this is happening now is because your party wants to extend free health care to illegals. And of course, both sides are saying, no, 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 you're wrong. You're lying. So I don't know where we go from here, but I open with this. And I'm not generally in favor of this, but you wonder if the answer here. And I've always said if you let medical people run this whole thing and keep the politicos out of it, is the answer to this, especially on the healthcare side, and I know you're going to jump down my throat here, but hear me out in just a second here, is the eventual answer to this some sort of an eventual transition to a government-run national health care plan for all? And the reason I ask that is because you have two fronts being fought in this political gab fest right now that center on health care. One is Obamacare, which you remember the battle we had on that in when 2012, I think that was finally instituted, 2011 or 2012 or something about that. And they're talking about, well, you know, the tax credits here and the Trump White House wants to get rid of that. And again, also, how do we extend health care to illegals, undocumented, non-citizens, whatever way you want to put that. But to me, most of this, and maybe I'm reading this wrong, I don't think so. But I look at this from a few feet away, the 30,000-foot view, and I said, well, wait a minute. This is all in some way, shape, or form, whether it's Obamacare, whether it's Medicaid money, whether it's state money or whatever, this is all circulating in some way, shape, or form on health care. Something that I don't know whether we don't want to do it, there's too much political pressure not to do it. I don't know. I don't care. Help me out here. Talk or text 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Should the U.S. eventually transition to a government-run national health care plan for all? I'm not in favor of that, but we don't seem to be making any manner of progress on this. And if you look at the yelling and the screaming on this now, on this government shutdown, which might last a few days, I don't know, what they say at the top of the hour on CBS, you're talking about the longest having been 35 days or the last one. I mean, I don't know how you fix this. And now, again, a lot of this is trying to ease back on the Obamacare tax credits. I mean, why do we even have Obamacare? Why don't we just go with Medicare for all or something? I don't know. I'm not an expert here. But I see both sides screaming and yelling about this, and it just gets tedious after a while. Figure it out. And I'm not saying people should be made to give up their private health care, but man, oh, man. We have Medicare in place. Let it extend to people who are on the lower end of the spectrum or figure it out. You want national health care? I don't know. I do not know. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC on Connecticut Today. So a good part of why we're in a government shutdown now apparently has to do with tax credits and what's been called Obamacare. The slang is Obamacare. The official name is the Affordable Care Act. Democrats say they want to extend the ACA subsidies because there's a need to prevent big premium hikes for millions of Americans, says here. Republicans saying, no, we're not going to put that in any budget measure because they wanted a clean stopgap measure. In other words, the Republicans are telling the Democrats, let's just fund the government here and let's get it back up and underway. But again, there's all this electioneering, because again, you do have the midterms coming up next year. About a year from now, we'll be awash in the midterm stuff. And the Republicans are saying, no, we'll debate this, but we're not going to put it in an extension of a spending authority. Now, my point is this. Why do we even have health care as a question here? I mean, we shouldn't need the Affordable Care Act. I mean, it was supposed to be the be-all and end-all, and all you hear about is how the premiums go up and up and up. And even people around the Obamacare founding, when in 2011 or 2012, saying, hey, let's just add another part of Medicare here. Why are we doing this? Because this is always going to become a pain, and you're seeing it now because it gets caught up in this debate here. This shouldn't even be part of a debate. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Maybe the best thing to do on some way, shape, or form, because we kind of already have a national health care program, you know? It's called Medicare. I'll be on it in a few months. It's called Medicare. We even have, you know, statewide plans called Medicaid. Now, Medicaid's for the indigent poor, but we all know what Medicare is. Why does Obamacare even exist? People said it was it wasn't going to function right because the premiums would keep going up and up and up. And now you have an extension of subsidies, of tax subsidies and other subsidies designed to help pay off these premiums, which are going to keep going up. What a mess. And now this is part of a shutdown push? Oh, my God. So listen, I'm just asking you, we'll get to the phones in a second. Should the U.S. eventually transition to a government-run national health care plan for all? Maybe. I say no, but there are some people out there who would want it. And maybe this whole discussion of shutdown stuff and Obamacare policies, maybe that we wouldn't even need that. I don't know. You tell me. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Talk or text. Barry in Shelton starts us off today. Barry, how are you? What's up?
Oh, fine, Paul, and thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
First, I love listening to you because it gives me a chance to yell at my radio.
Excellent.
Whether I agree
Excellent.
Or disagree.
Excellent.
I always sit around with a couple of friends who are on both sides of politics that we can discuss without killing each other.
Yeah.
We did agree on a semi-solution, because there's never a simple solution for a major problem,
mm-hmm.
with health insurance.
Yeah.
I would take and deem that in health insurance companies or the health insurance part of an insurance company be made a non-profit, a not-for-profit organization.
Yeah.
It would still have to work. It would force itself to be more efficient.
Yep.
And these few billion here or there that go to tax to dividend holders and overpaid CEOs whose job depends on a stock price would eliminate that whole incentive.
Yeah, I mean, you would be able to.
Yeah,
I mean, you and Barry, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. I mean, maybe. But then again, that would take a transition of probably decades, Barry, as you mentioned, because those stock dividends and everything, they're in people's pension plans, 401ks, individual portfolios. But then again, you would get pushback from these companies saying, well, you know, without investors investing some of the private capital in us, we can't keep in business. We can't stay in business. But the reason I bring this up here is if you peel back the layers, I love that. That's a real corporate thing. Let's peel back the layers here. This whole government shutdown thing is pretty much revolving around one side's desire to make sure that some health care tax credits for the Obamacare, for the Affordable Care Act, are maintained. And the other side, the Republicans, saying, well, no, we don't want to do that. Plus, there's language here, although the Democrats now say that's not true, that would open up more health care to illegals. And my point is, maybe, and as much as, other countries that have this, wait times are horrendous, we'd have to design a system all for us, but maybe it's time that we reconsider this going, you know, maybe 100, 200 years down the road. I don't know. Because if it's this bad to fund government shutdowns, there's something wrong. My humble opinion. I could be wrong here, as I usually am. And Matt in Fairfield. Matt, how are you?
Happy Thursday.
It's Wednesday.
How are you doing?
It's Wednesday.
I'm sorry. My apology. Happy Wednesday.
Thank you.
Okay, so two points. Number one, I totally agree.
Yeah.
The government does not know what it's doing with big programs. Just ask veterans. The government does not need to do that.
Yeah.
To your point about illegals, take care of the American citizens first, and then worry about the illegals. But this morning, you had Richard Blumenthal on as a guest.
Yeah.
And they were talking about the budget and health care.
Yeah.
And he was insisting that the Democrats are not looking for monies for illegals when it comes to health care benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And a caller comes in and says, what about illegals, Senator? And he says, no, only American citizens. And your the spokesperson that had him on said, well, what about the Connecticut Husky program? Doesn't that give benefits to illegals? Well, guess what? He had to acknowledge it. And as soon as he did, and before the caller got to ask him more questions about it, it was 23 skidoo. I got to go. Goodbye.
Okay. I didn't hear that, but I'll take your word for it. Okay. All right.
Yeah. And so I listen to that and I say, I'm looking for some honesty from one side or another because I'm a big political skeptic.
Yeah.
Don't come on and tell me only American citizens are going to get the benefits under your plan that the Republicans are denying, only to find out that illegals are getting benefits under Husky, and you're lying. I was very disappointed with that. And then he just takes off because he doesn't want to have to answer that question.
Matt, you would think, and Matt, thank you for the call, appreciate it. Matt, you would think that a country that landed men on the moon in 1969 with relatively primitive technology compared to what we have today, but with an understanding of orbital mechanics and physics and all that, you would think we could figure this out. But apparently we can't. Henry, hang on. We'll get to you. Oliver in Brantford, hang on. We'll get to you as well. We'll do a little news here, traffic and weather together. But again, just looking at what I was going to talk about today, and I'm seeing, as our last caller laid out, you're seeing two sides just smashing their heads together in D.C., I mean, it's like, hey, government shutdown. Here's the sound of us smashing our heads together on the wall. Driving finishing nails with your head. Yes. Democrats say, well, it's only for Obamacare people. And Republicans say, no, you're trying to sneak in coverage for illegals. Where does it end? Joining us right now, as she is known to do from D.C., outstanding CBS News reporter Olivia Rinaldi. There has been stuff, news and stuff on other aspects of the Trump White House, including drug pricing. Hey, Olivia, it's Paul. How are you? So what is a story that I saw a little bit on, but maybe it's getting overshadowed by this shutdown stuff? What's up with drug pricing?
Hey, Paul, it's good to be with you from the North Lawn of the White House at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yesterday there was a big announcement at the White House where they have an agreement with Pfizer to lower prescription drug costs in the U.S. This is the first direct deal that this administration has made with a pharmaceutical company. This came from this executive order that Trump had signed back in May that had asked for these companies to voluntarily lower their prices under what's called the fair pricing policy here, where the U.S. consumers would pay essentially the same amount as other countries do as far as drug pricing. Now, a lot of those are subsidized, so this White House is doing it through Medicaid at the moment, but they're hoping eventually that the prices will be brought down regardless because they're hoping that a lot of these drugs get made here in the U.S. And that's actually something that the CEO of Pfizer, who was here in the Oval Office yesterday, said was part of the impetus for why they made this deal with the White House was because they don't want to be subject to those tariffs, those impending tariffs on pharmaceutical companies. So because of that, they decided to strike this deal.
All right. In fact, that's what I was going to ask Olivia. Was we know it's the carrot and the stick. So the stick, if you will, was the threat of tariffs then, correct?
And he said it played no small part in this decision that they made.
All right. Olivia Rinaldi, live from the White House lawn. Olivia, thank you. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
All right. There you go. All right. Bye-bye.